We have a wonderful guest. Her name is Diana Johnson, and I recorded this earlier this afternoon. And I think if Charlotte agrees, we will play it for you now. P89.5 FM, The Taylor Report. I'm Phil Taylor, the host. And fortunately, today we have a chance to talk to Diana Johnson, who is the author of several great books, most notably Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia, NATO, and Western Delusions, and Queen of Chaos, The Misadventures of Hillary Clinton. And Diana, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for calling me up.
Of course, today we want to remember or get your thoughts about this wonderful man, Ed Herman. You wrote a terrific tribute to him, I thought, in the Counterpunch, November 15, 2017. By the way, his loss at this particular moment is very, very grave indeed, isn't it? Because he's made a wonderful contribution to the struggle for peace in the world, and critiquing the role of journalism in creating wars.
Well, yes, he certainly did, and of course, his loss is terrible at any moment. But at this moment, there's something really awful about it, because in fact, all of the things that he criticized about media control are now worse than just about ever. I mean, what I mean by that is that the media, aside from distorting the truth, to put it mildly, mm-hmm. have now embarked on this campaign to label any criticism, any other, any more accurate view of reality as fake news. Mm-hmm. So there's a real campaign on against anybody who questions the narrative that is being fed to us by the mainstream media, who, of course, are working for the military-industrial complex, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed, I mean, of course, the great book, and incidentally, he does rightly get, should be given the credit for initiating the book itself, Manufacturing Consent, the concept, and I guess the bulk of the writing, he, together with Noam Chomsky, such an important book. And the issue that they addressed that has been in a state of flux, and I'd like your thoughts about this. Of course, when they first published the book, there was this ideological drive behind the need for propaganda that they describe, and that was, of course, anti-communism. But then it turned into other things, such as anti-terrorism, somewhat anti-Islam, but definitely today, anti-Russia. I mean, it's quite, I've never seen it so bad as this.
No, I know. I know. And it's really unbelievable how it's gone. But it just shows, you see, that they find some pretext. If it's not communism, it's Russia, it's something else. Because the basic point is to keep Americans alarmed. So alarmed about some foreign enemy. If it's not some foreign enemy, it's some people we have to rescue from some thing. And to keep people in such a state of mind that they will support putting the fortune of the country, trillions of dollars, into military buildup, wars, etc. I mean, this is basically to keep the military industrial complex going, because you see, the military industrial complex has really become the center of the economy. You see, my point is that a Wall Street investor who invests in a business, the business might fail, but when you invest in armaments, you know that the government, the Pentagon, is going to pay you, and you're going to get a profit. So the military industrial complex is the biggest source of sure profits. Mm-hmm. And that's why the whole the whole establishment wants to keep it going. And to keep it going, you've got to keep scaring the people to death about some horrible enemy. And you know, if it wasn't communism, then you find some other. If mm-hmm. after Russia, there'll always be another. There'll always be another until, I don't know, until maybe it all explodes and the United States gets destroyed by its folly. Yes.
We're speaking to Diana Johnson. The article is in Counterpunch, November 15, tribute to Ed Herman. And you have several nice turns of phrase in describing him, and you say that he identified the diverse techniques. Because we do seem to be almost like they're almost like the advertising industry. They think of new ways to sell something. And
yes, and
you hit on this point that, I mean, these wonderful terms, and not only are they afraid of something, but they have the right to protect, they have the need to prevent genocide, and you call this, and to have what you call oxymoronic humanitarian war, which is seem to be going on everywhere, without a Congress, without a discussion with the American people.
You know, I knew it personally for about 40 years, I guess. I wanted to point out, I mean, he was such a nice person, and everybody knows that. He was so generous, so kind, so modest. He never cared about taking credit for things. He just felt part of it. But he was really, his passion really was, against war, obviously, but I think he had a moral passion against lies and against double standards, which is a form of lies. And you see, in so much of his writing, what really pushes him is this indignation over the double standards. The example is the worthy or unworthy victim. You know, the people we kill are unworthy victims in the fact that, well, it doesn't matter, or we're sorry, or but the when it, somebody else is killed, it becomes a reason for us to go to war. And so he saw very well how this double standard was used to justify our aggressive wars all over the place. And you see, that's something that's been very misunderstood by his critics, by the way.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? He's what?
I said this has been misunderstood or deliberately misunderstood.
I noticed, yes, you underline that point in your article. You said he wasn't denying that people were victims and massive loss of life in the various theaters of these wars, but that he was denying this as the pretext for a war.
Well, exactly. You see, I feel the way he does. I can get pretty annoyed with all these hypocrites who want to go on and on and on about the victims. And for instance, it must be 8,000 people who were killed in Srebrenica. Although I like it. I think I've investigated it. That figure is overblown. Mm-hmm. Don't deny a massacre.
Yes.
But these people care much more about going on and on and on about the people who've already been killed than about preventing other people from being killed. You know, it's the worship of the dead at the expense of the living. That's what all this going on, all of these genocide, that has become the slogan for U.S. aggression, much represented by Samantha Power, who made a career out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big part of the whole psychological war program is to make genocide this evil that we must use all our military force to stop. Mm-hmm. And Ed saw through this hypocrisy. And that is dangerous, because when you expose these righteous lies, these self-righteous lies, mm-hmm. then, of course, you get attacked for denial and all of these things. But as I say, all that he was denying were the excuses to make aggressive war.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we are. I wonder, by the way, about how well they're doing now, given that they're starting to encounter this resistance, or I guess we could say pushback, from other major powers who also exist and assert the right to exist. like Russia, China. And what led up to this kind of ugly moment now that we're living in with Russia is that the idea that the U.S. could just intervene in the name of saving people, particularly, I guess we could say, with Syria, most recent, where the U.S. almost went to war. They were, you know, I thought
well,
we were within about 48 hours of our of war there. And,
yeah, well, we've been backing the other side, mm-hmm. you know. So in a sense, we have been at war, but we don't quite there. They've been backing various good Islamic
But that concept of humanitarian war has finally run into to other states saying you actually don't have that unilateral right to do that, which is. Seems to be creating alarm in Washington, which brings us kind of to this ugly situation where now, if you offer criticism of these wars, you are becoming identified. You must be a Russian. Stephen Cohen is about to be crucified, I gather.
Well, I wrote a little semi-black humor piece, by the way, which was just published in Global Report.
Yes, Global Research.
Global Research, I mean, because the situation has gotten so fantastic that I practically can't write seriously anymore. See, I think the U.S. establishment has talked itself into its propaganda, and so we're going just all over the edge. They're going crazy because they're believing their own propaganda, and they're going to insist that everybody else believe it. That's this Russia thing. It's a total. I mean, to say that the Russians could influence a U.S. election, I mean, of course it's projection because the U.S. has done everything to influence other people's elections, including the Russian one when it got Yeltsin, that drunken Yeltsin, reelected.
Yes. Even boasted, but, as you say. They boasted about interfering.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, that's been described exactly how they did it and so on. Now, there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that Russia can have another opinion, but I should think so. I mean, I should think it's perfectly natural that the Russian opinions would be different from American opinions. For instance, they don't want to make war with us.
Yes.
So they don't want war, so that makes it a different opinion. They want.
Yes.
That makes them dangerous because they have a different policy from ours because
policy of respecting
international law.
Yes, and by the way, assuming we had rational voters or people wanted to exercise that right in the United States, some of them might actually be interested in the opinions of Russia.
Well,
not afraid of the fear factor that they brought in. Yes.
I think people are, but you see, they've been accused of, they come in with this hacking, oh dear. You see, this is so mysterious. The trouble is, now you have all this electronic stuff that nobody can understand. It's not like the cow going in and out of the barn. You don't know exactly how people are doing what. So it's so easy to come up with this thing, oh, they're hacking our election. I mean, this is fantasy, but the United States seems to be living more and more on total fantasy. It seems to me it's losing touch with reality. And in fact, I have to write about this sometime, that the new American freedom is freedom from reality.
Yeah.
And you see it in many cultural things.
Well, the freedom to obey, to go to football stadiums and salute and to pledge loyalty while watching sporting events,
soldiers on the field. I'm worse than that. I think it's also the freedom to decide. I'm just reading about this, what gender you are, what nationality you are, you remake reality to suit you as an individual. I'm not even talking about the group things, but I think that's a form of when a lot of individuals are being unreal, forgot about reality, it becomes a kind of mass unreality.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think Americans are used to living there and all the entertainment. There's just so much of a diversion, and the wars and the propaganda are a part of that entertainment. And, you know, Hollywood plays a huge role in indoctrinating
yes.
Americans in the need to go to war is all the time. They're doing that.
And always the need to be ruthless and to break laws and to torture. They make movies in which they glamorize the people who make the decision to torture.
Yes, and it's a woman who does that, just to show that we women can be just as brutal and horrible as the men, which I think is probably true. But it's just that they're not as strong physically, so, you know, it's historically not been. But now that you can kill at a distance of thousands of miles with drones, why, I suppose women, if they want to be, and thinking that, in fact, there's no such thing as femininity anymore, there's no such thing as, that's not a nice, you know, to be feminine and to say that you prefer peaceful things as a woman. Well, that would be showing your inferiority, I suppose.
That would be unpatriotic, actually.
Not just unpatriotic, it would be unfeminist.
Unfeminist. We're speaking to Diane Johnson, great books, The Fool's Crusade, and, of course, Queen of Chaos about Hillary Clinton. By the way, I really urge people read the excellent piece in Global Research, because that was very nicely done in describing the various agencies in American power structure. Now, lastly, just again about Ed Herman, you describe him as a very gentle man. I guess I only knew him by phone, but I know he was a personal friend of yours, and you said he had a real drive toward justice. And I wonder, didn't he also, as sweet as he was and nice, he was a very tough individual, right?
Well, he was mentally very tough, you know. That's the kind of toughness that is not celebrated anymore by Hollywood. Mm-hmm. He had a moral toughness.
Integrity.
You can call it integrity. It was very strong moral strength, and it was visible in his personal life, as well as his writing. He was a man of great principle, and that, of course, is really pretty much going out of style. He was quite extraordinary in his generosity, and everything he did, he never thought of himself as put himself forward. He was doing everything he always thought as part it's not exactly a movement, it's not exactly, I don't know what, but, you know, he liked so much to write books with co-authors. He liked to cooperate. He liked to feel that we are all doing this together, and he was terribly helpful in many ways, financially and other, to other people who were pursuing that path of exposing lies.
Yeah. And you called him the godfather of media critique, and I really like that. I thought that was very apt. Diana Johnson, it's great talking to you. We really appreciate hearing more about Ed Herman. I hope people go to his works, and also I hope everybody continues to follow your writing. Thank you very, very much.
Well, thanks for talking to me, and let's remember Ed.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
It's a Taylor Report, and that was Diana Johnson. We're very glad we could talk to her. And it is CIUT 89.5 FM. We want a little musical interlude here. And in my opinion, Mel Tillis has died. Mel Tillis died at 85. I don't know if you know, he had a speech impediment. By the way, he talked about how he was discriminated against. It was seriously, because of that, he lost some contracts, etc. But Mel Tillis was a very brilliant songwriter. And in the middle of the Vietnam War, he wrote a song. And a lot of I knew a lot of guys strumming on guitars and singing about the war, but maybe they were accomplishing something. But he wrote a song that really hit people in the gut, and we're going to play a bit of it right now.